Excision number 21872, wheel 2.
Eddie Wallace, rail 2.
Yes. Yes, we were dropped up the on the top of the hill by Fort Whitley, where these London firemen were waiting, and we told them that if they wanted a meal and if they wanted accommodation, then they would have to come with us through the city, and we will find them a place over at Gosport. We didn't tell them exactly where it was. And so we marched them right through Cosham, North End, Fratton. We couldn't get through Commercial Road, so we went through Fratton by the Plaza Cinema, and then down past the Guildhall, back of the Guildhall there, down to Portsea. No, we didn't. We marched them down to Old Portsmouth, to Broad Street, to the car ferry that was there. And they got on the car ferry there at Broad Street over to Gosport, where we reformed them and marched them along the Gosport High Street to Gosport Fire Station, which was in the main road in those days. And we left them there, having been met at the ferry by Reggie Cleary in the Morris Commercial with all their kit, which we handed out to them there, and then they made them carry them themselves to the fire station over there, and we left them there.
So when you first met them, did you ask to speak to their senior?
Yes, yes. They had a divisional officer with them, but I couldn't tell you at this time there from where he came, whether he was from London or whether he was in one of these stations outside. And, oh yes, he was most upset to think he should be met by two ordinary firemen and not a sergeant, inspector or superintendent or even the chief constable, who was theoretically the officer in charge of the fire service. Yeah. But just told him point blank that we were tired ourselves, been out at fighting fires since the first raid started around about 7 o'clock, and we wanted to go back to our bed. So he saw in the end that if they wanted to get anywhere, they would have to march through.
At what time of night was this?
This was about 8:30, 9 o'clock the following morning on the 11th. On the 11th of January, we finally got to our beds, because Ron Drew and I, we slept in the same bedroom there. We finally got to our beds, I suppose, when they were about 11:30 that morning. Wow. So we've been up since early the 10th of January.
What did the mood and demeanour of the London firemen seem to be?
They were very sullen. Very sullen. Wouldn't speak. Why? I don't know, really. Maybe it may have been our attitude, perhaps, knowing full well that they wouldn't come in to assist us during the raid itself. But,
what was the march through the streets of Portsmouth like?
Well, it was a shambles. It was a shambles. You couldn't call it a march. It was just formed up in threes or fours. I can't remember now. They just marched. We just walked them through, really. You couldn't march. We called them, we marched them, but I mean, it was just a shambles. Walk through to get down there. Of course, there was no transport, you see. The roads were more or less blocked. Public transport was non-existent at that particular time. The trains were not running. They'd been stopped at Havant and also at Fareham, coming in from the other side. So you had no trains coming in.
Was it intimidating walking through the streets?
No.
With all the fires?
No, it wasn't intimidating. I mean, they'd been used to fires as well up there. But not, I don't think, to the extent of being up top, looking down, and seeing what it was really like. You see, as I said earlier on, if you're at a fire, then you don't take notice of what's going on around you. You're dealing with that particular fire, and that's it.
Did you see them in action the next
day? No. I went to bed. I went back to my room and went to bed, and that was it.
Do you remember other occasions when outside forces came in?
Yes, we had firemen coming in from Southampton, the borough of Southampton, Havant, and other areas around Fareham. But most of them knew Portsmouth anyway, coming in from surrounding areas. They did all the shopping in the city and things like that in those days.
Would they have compatible equipment?
Oh, yes. Yeah. They were AFS men, and it was a government-sponsored fire service, the auxiliary fire service, and standardised equipment. Unlike the Portsmouth City Police Fire Brigade and the Dockyard Fire Brigade, which was also a police fire brigade, but it was the Royal Marine Police in those days. They had different fire equipment to us, different hoses, different connectors and everything. So we had to have adapters whenever we went into the dockyard.
Did that cause any problems?
Oh, yes, it did. Yeah. And it wasn't until the National Fire Service was formed on August the 18th, 1941, that every fire brigade, every city, had to have the same what would you call them there? Standpipes and things like that. They had to be regularised so that if you were called away to another city or another town or wherever, then your equipment would fit their equipment, and that was it.
Was it a big problem?
What?
The compatibility of the equipment.
Well, it was. It was, yeah, because you only had so many adapters as far as Portsmouth was concerned and the dockyard. So 9 times out of 10, it wasn't the AFS that went into the dockyard, it was the regular brigade that went into the dockyard, into the naval base there, simply because we had the adapters on our machines.
Any other memories you've got of the Portsmouth Blitz?
I always remember on one occasion, I can't remember which one it was now, we were sent up to, we'd been out all night, and we were sent up to Hilsey Barracks, which is no longer there, rugby camp, which is part of Hilsey Barracks, for breakfast. And we had a double-decker bus put at our disposal. I remember that. We were up top, my wife, who was in the AFS at those days, myself and several other chaps. We were up top, going through Stubbington Avenue, trees either side of the avenue. As the bus was going through, the branches banging against the roof of the bus, and one wag, okay, machine guns. Of course, everybody dived under the seats, me included. That's one of the more humorous side. But no, you see, you forget all the rotten side of warfare, and you only remember the more pleasant side of it. You blanket it all from your mind.
Did your uniforms look like fire brigade uniforms today?
That's the uniform.
Can you describe it in words?
It was Melton. The uniform was waterproof too, heavy, red tabs on your collar, leather belt, wooden handled steel axe, and jack boots. We wore cork and leather helmets in those days, but if we were going out, if it was in a raid, there was a raid on, and we were going out at that particular time, then of course we reverted to steel helmets. We wore steel helmets in those days. But if we were going to what we call a civilian fire during the daytime, something like that, then we reverted to the fireman's helmet.
Did you feel any sense of indignation about the Germans bombing the city?
Oh, yes. Well, it's a lovely city being razed to the ground. I mean, when you come to think of the age of some of the buildings in the city going back to Nelson's time, before then, there was the Garrison Church, which was built in 1190-something or other. That was burnt out, Portsmouth Garrison Church. Star and Garter Hotel, where Nelson stayed, and it had his signature written on one of the windows with a ring, you know, a diamond ring, written his signature there. That'd be gone. The George Hotel in the High Street, that'd be gone. That was where Nelson stayed before he set sail for Trafalgar. That'd be gone. Portsmouth Cathedral, a lot of that was hit. And all the way around that area, old Portsmouth, all Georgian houses, a lot of them were gone, there's not many left now. Yeah.
So, what happened to you next?
Well, on August the 18th, the regular brigades all over the country amalgamated with the Auxiliary Fire Service and became the National Fire Service. And we were given the option of either remaining in the newly formed National Fire Service or returning to beat duties. Well, young as I was, I had helped to train some of those AFS officers when they became National Fire Service officers, and I would have been under them. Well, to be honest, I didn't fancy that. A lot of us didn't, so we came out onto a beat. And I went to Albert Road Police Station, which incidentally is now a public house. It seems to me they pick these old police stations and form them into public houses. Anyway, I stuck it for a year. And then in October 1942, once all the heavy raids on the city had finished, they still had raids, but not heavy raids, not only on this city, but all over the country, the Home Office decreed that all regular police officers under the age of 27, and all war reserves under the age of 30 could be classified as no longer in reserved occupations and could join the services. So, I was called up in the October, late October 1942, and I went into the army at Colchester, Hyderabad Barracks at Colchester with the Somerset Light Infantry.
Before we go on with that, could I just ask you about that year you had on the beat, which must have been 41-42?
Yeah.
What was your year on the police beat in Portsmouth?
Well, we were working 12 hours a day then. Normally, of course, in peacetime, it was 8 hours a day, but during the war, it was 12 hours a day. And if you were home and the sirens went, then you had to report to your police station where you normally did duty and stand by in case you were wanted. As you know, when the sirens went, it normally meant that about 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, and there was anticipated there would be a raid on your city. At one time, you used to have what was known as air raid message yellow, air raid message red, no, air raid message purple, air raid message red, and then air raid message white. Well, on the purple, it meant that enemy aircraft had been witnessed coming across the channel, but where they were going, we didn't know at that particular time. Then you had air raid message purple, which meant that enemy aircraft were more or less coming in your direction. Then you had air raid message red, when that meant enemy raid imminent, and the sirens then went. And air raid message white, of course, was really all clear when it was all over. And you had a police officer from each police station had a bicycle. This is the outbreak of war. And whenever air raid message yellow was received, he went round to all the policemen's houses in this area, knocking them up and telling them to report to the police station. Every message yellow. Well, of course, the chaps weren't getting any sleep, weren't getting any sleep at all. So they altered that to air raid message purple. They only went in if they were knocked up, air raid message purple. But of course, the poor Bobby on that bicycle couldn't get round to every house. So they used to come in on sirens.
What other duties would a policeman have in bombing?
He would be an incident officer. He would take control of an incident. Or a warden. You had police officers who were specifically trained as incident officers, most of us were, and you had certain wardens were trained as well for that specific purpose. And that meant, of course, you took control once you got to an incident. You located premises that would do as an incident headquarters. You called fire brigade if wanted, the ambulances if wanted, various departments of the civil defence if required. You were in sole command.
What were the main problems of doing that job?
Well, there's a lot of antagonism from air raid wardens, I do know that. Because 9 times out of 10, we used to take over an air raid warden's post and make that our incident room, you see. And they didn't like that because they thought, well, this is our warden post, we should be doing that. But I suppose a police officer had more authority than an air raid warden did. Well, we did have more authority, of course.
How did they show their antagonism?
No, it was just by word of speech. Just the way they spoke to you. They cooperated. They had to. They had to cooperate. And contrary to what some people have said in the past, there wasn't much looting in this city. Wasn't much looting at all. I can only recall 2 incidences of looting where looters appeared before the courts. Anyway, one of those was a dateful one. But,
what's happened during those?
In the majority of times, you see, you got the Navy and the troops used to come in as well. And if any value was found, it was put into a central place and guarded by a serviceman. Maybe a police officer as well with them. If premises were partially damaged, should we say, like a farrier's or somewhere like that, partially damaged, then I used to put a guard on outside, an armed guard outside of that. But I cannot recall any instances of looting, what I call real looting, at all. And yet, there was an article in the paper, an article in the paper the other day concerning a book which had been written. And in it, it was mentioned that Portsmouth, the morale in Portsmouth was very, very low. Looting was prevalent. Well, that was absolutely incorrect. Absolutely incorrect. Our morale here was excellent in this city. It was excellent, later date.
So what were the 2 looting incidents which you do recollect?
Well, one was of a police officer, I regret to say, who was put on guard outside what was his name? His name Debenhams in Southsea. Hanley's it was called in those days, that's right, a big departmental store, Hanley's. Had been hit by a bomb. And a lot of stuff had been dragged out, clothing, furs and things like that, to be taken up to the depot, to be dumped up to the central depot here in Portsmouth, where there was a big dump, and they couldn't take it and bury it or throw it away. Throw it away, in other words, they couldn't use it. Well, this police officer, who was on guard there, took a couple of the furs that were down there to be thrown away, and... Well, an inspector came along, and there were 2 police officers there involved, actually, but one got away. In fact, one of them was... No, I better not tell you his name, because he's still around. But he came into the fire brigade. He was taken off of beat duties and put into the police fire brigade. But the other one appeared before the magistrates, and he got sentenced. And strange as it may seem, when he finished his sentence, he joined the Hong Kong police force and rose to be a superintendent out there. Yeah, it was very dodgy. And I suppose they had to make an example of somebody, and they chose him because he was in a position of trust, you see.
Was he sentenced to prison?
Yes, he was sentenced, but I can't tell you. No. I know it was Winchester he went to, but I can't tell you.
And what about the other incident?
The other incident was a chap who had stolen jewellery from Samuels in Commercial Road. And he was caught by the officer on the beat there. Well, yeah, on the beat, you know, the police officer who was around at that particular time. So he went up. He got, I think, got about 2 years, I think, from what I can recall. Long time ago. You don't remember these things now.
Why do you think there was a relative lack of looting?
I don't really know. There weren't many men folk in the city. Most of them had, compared to what it was before the war, most of them, I suppose, like the majority of compatible sized cities, towns, had been called up to the armed forces, I suppose, or in the civil defence or something like that, fire services. They were all doing their little bit. And I think it was just the ragtag that were doing a little bit of looting, you know. Those that were unfit for service and things like that, I suppose they really are. But as I say, it's such a long, long time ago, 60 years ago, you just can't remember that much now.
What makes you think that morale was so high during the
war? Well, it was high. I know it was high. Being a member of the public, shall I say, myself, you've still got that out in the rain and mixed with people. Oh, yes. If we could get hold of Hitler or Jerry or somebody, you know, we had a good go at them. Oh, no, our morale was okay. Our morale was definitely okay. Yeah.
What was other law and order like during that period in 41-42?
Well, it's strange, isn't it? Life went on, blackout. You never got any muggings like you do now. No women were molested, or if they were, it was very, very seldom did you hear of it. Certainly not at the rate they are these days, this time in our lives, you know. None of the front doors of houses used to be kept open. People used to pop in and out and say hello, things like that. People used to have their keys on a string behind the letterbox and let themselves in. Oh, well, no. You could walk in the blackout without fear of being molested at all.
So how did you like this period serving as a...
As a beat officer.
Beat officer.
Well, I knew that I was doing a little bit for King and Country, I suppose. Because although you still acted a normal police officer's role, you still assisted the armed forces in convoys and things like that, you know, seeing them through the city. Our main trouble, of course, was at night time during the blackout, when people used to leave lights on and things like that. That was the main trouble, really. And it's surprising how far away an ordinary cigarette, a light, it can be seen. Not that we're that worried, yes, at all, of course, but a torchlight or even a chink in a window, you could see from miles away. It's surprising, the blackout.
Would they cooperate when you asked them to?
Oh, 9 times out of 10 they did. Oh, yes, 9 times out of 10. You had the odd one, you haven't got anything better to do sort of thing, which you get these days anyway, but...
No, you were just about to tell me about going to Colchester, please.
Yes, I joined the Somerset Light Infantry for my 6 weeks initial army training. And I rather liked Colchester. I had relatives living there as well, so I was made very welcome. The old cavalry barracks, Hyderabad Barracks and Mehani Barracks, they're at the, I think there was the eastern end of the town from what I can remember. I understand, incidentally, that Hyderabad Barracks is now a listed building and they can't pull it down. My God, they should have pulled that down years ago. When I joined, we were given a palliasse and told to go downstairs to where the stables used to be and you'll find straw. You can fill your palliasse with that. That's your mattress, you see. What you get down there, and there was no straw, just a few shreds of what had been left, you know. And you just, like chaff, and you just put it into your palliasse and also your pillow and go upstairs. No beds, no beds. You're on the floor. You're on the floor. Oh, yes. No windows, no glass in the windows. And that was October, November 1942. 1942, yeah. And, of course, the uniform you were given was the khaki battle dress, and it was stiff. It was full of DDT, an anti-insect painter, really, and it stunk to high heaven. And... you had to wear it for quite a few weeks before it became pliable, really. In fact, lots of chaps, they used to put it in water and try and soak them out. But unfortunately, they used to shrink the uniforms.
What happened to you in the training?
The training. Well, a lot of my unit, in my... What was it called? A section. It was called a section infantry, being a gunner. I've got to think back. A section. In that particular company were ex-police officers, all called up like I was, you see. And we had done foot drill while we were in the service. That was part of our police training in those days. I did my foot drill down at Colwart Barracks, down at Old Portsmouth. Anyway, that's beside the point. And we all knew... our left and right and sort of thing. All we didn't know was rifle drill. But that came quite easy, really. And often or not, after 4 weeks, our section was picked upon as the ideal drill section. And we used to give, you know, drill performances.
And army discipline, how did you take to that?
Oh, didn't worry us at all. I mean, in my day, as a police officer, if you were approached by a sergeant, you stood to attention and you called him sergeant. If an inspector came along, you called him sir and you saluted. Something they don't do these days. In fact, I think they're all on first name tax now. But if you're spoken to by a corporal, well, there were corporals, not bombardiers, there were corporals in the infantry. You just stood to attention, called him bombardier. You called him corporal, sergeant. If a commissioned officer came up, or the sergeant major, or battery sergeant major, or company sergeant major, of course I keep referring to battery sergeant majors being gunner, you called him sir. And that was it.
How did the people in charge of the basic training treat you?
I think they treated us fair. For that time of our, you know, that period, discipline was far more severe then than what it is now. But as I say, that didn't hurt us at all. Well, it didn't hurt me anyway, because I was used to discipline. No.
And after the basic training?
Basic training, I was then posted to Arborfield, 232 Training Regiment, Royal Artillery. And I must have done 6 weeks there as well, I suppose, learning how to fire various guns. mainly 25 pounders and 3.7s. Arborfield, yeah. Miles from anywhere.
Where is it?
Just outside Reading. Near Wokingham. Near Wokingham, yeah, Wokingham, not Wokingham.